are now listening to a podcast made in collaboration with the Copenhagen College Radio.
Hey, everybody. Welcome to episode 56 of the Social Media and Politics Podcast, bringing you expert insights into how social media is changing the political game. I'm your host, Michael Becetta, political scientist at the University of Copenhagen. Remember, you can connect with us on Twitter at SMNP Podcast or check out our website, socialmediaandpolitics.org. All right, y'all. Thanks so much for tuning in. If you've been listening to this series for a while, you might remember a couple of episodes we did around the technology developed by a group called Who Targets Me. They're a group trying to bring transparency to Facebook ads, and especially Facebook ads targeted by political campaigns. So if you go back to episode 27, you can hear all about Who Targets Me and their technology. And then episode 45, we looked at how the technology was used in the Irish abortion referendum. So I think this technology is really cool, and it's been on my radar for a while now. And I was super excited to see some academic research being put out with data collected by Who Targets Me. And that research is being headed by Dr. Nick Anstead, who's my guest today. He is an associate professor in media and communications at the London School of Economics and Political Sciences. And together with his colleagues Jayo Magales, Richard Stupart, and Damian Tambini, they've written a draft paper called Political Advertising on Facebook, the Case of the 2017 United Kingdom General Election. And I'll link to that in the show notes. It was presented at a conference in Hamburg called ECPR, or the European Consortium of Political Research. So I caught up with Dr. Anstead on the fly to talk about his motivations behind the project, what types of analysis they were doing on this data. And I thought it'd be a great addition to the podcast because we've already had the practitioners on the show. And so I wanted to give you guys a feel about what academics are doing with this data and how we're thinking about the implications of targeted Facebook ads, particularly in this context of the 2017 British general elections. And I also think it's important because, you know, there's been so much discussion around transparency and the regulation of ads, which is something we get into in the interview. But the thing with academic publishing is it often takes, you know, over a year to write a paper. So a lot of times the findings really aren't disseminated outside of academic circles. So this research, it's fresh off the press and still in a draft version. So the final paper won't be out for some time. But I thought it'd be cool to connect with some of the other podcasts in the series and also give you guys a first look as to what's going on the academic side of studying Facebook targeted ads. And just a bit of backstory before we cut to the interview, I was interviewing Dr. Anstead after his presentation, and a very grumpy German caretaker came and kicked us out. And I don't understand German at all, but the meaning was clear. So around minute 20 of this interview, the sort of background noise is going to change because we moved outside and had to finish the interview out on a bench, which was quite pleasant and the first outdoor experience on this podcast. So without further ado, let me cut to the interview. My guest is Dr. Nick Anstead. He's an associate professor in media and communications at the LSE.
Dr. Anstead, thanks for taking the time out. Welcome to the Social Media and Politics Podcast.
It's lovely to be here.
So here we are at ECPR in Hamburg, where you're presenting a paper researching how British political parties use Facebook to advertise in the 2017 UK general elections. And I want to do a deep dive into that paper in a second, but first I'd like to ask why you decided to study Facebook advertising from an academic perspective. So obviously there's been a lot of coverage in the media about political campaigns' use of social media, but in your view, why is Facebook advertising an important object of study for political research?
Well, I guess let me make two points in response to that question. The first one is we talk about it a lot, and academics talk about it a lot, journalists talk about it a lot. Politicians talk about it a lot. But one of the things that's interesting is when you actually dive into that, how little we really know about it, how little data we actually have access to when we're studying it. So that's the sort of the big general reason. But then I guess I would offer a slightly more parochial reason as well, which is just based upon the British experience. So the UK has a very particular set of election regulations that it's used over the years. And one of the central things they've been embedded in that is the idea that you can't pay for television advertising. So in Britain, we don't have paid television advertising. And that has in many ways, I think, shaped the way our political parties communicate. And now suddenly we're in a situation where this newly emergent form of paid advertising is available to political parties. And it's not been regulated. There's been very little conversation about how it should be regulated. And so, you know, to us, myself and my co-authors, it seems really, really important that we actually understand that. And then we can have a debate about For example, do we need to think about regulating Facebook advertising in politics? Do we need to think about the way in which decisions were made in the 1950s and 60s about television advertising? And do we need to revisit those sorts of conversations about Facebook? At the moment, we're doing that without access to good data.
And that leads right well into my next question, which is, I think you make a really interesting critique in the beginning of the paper that researchers, and I would also add the media, might be overstating social media's role in impacting elections and their outcomes. And that critique stems from the idea, exactly what you've been talking about, there's been a lack of scientific testing about the effectiveness of social media campaigning. So could you unpack that argument for us and perhaps give us a brief overview of what type of academic research has been done in this area?
I think let's make a few points about this. I think it's impossible always to separate a technology from the political context in which it is deployed. So I think when you look at certain political events, you look at the election of Donald Trump, you look at the Brexit referendum in the United Kingdom, these are unexpected events. They are in some ways surprising events. They fly in the face of convention political wisdom. So we're looking for an explanation. For many people, they are also troubling events. So we're looking again for an explanation. So I think there's clearly, if you like, a narrative which Facebook fits into about these events. I'd add another ingredient as well to your sort of discussion. Yes, so academics talk about it, politicians talk about it, journalists talk about it. The other people I'd say who talk about it a lot are the types of people who are trying to sell this as a product. So the campaign consultants themselves. We talk a lot about Cambridge Analytica, for example, but I think something we can certainly accuse Cambridge Analytica of is overclaiming on their effectiveness. Mm-hmm. But in that sense, they fit a pattern of campaign consultants that have been involved in presidential campaigns for decades because have immediately afterwards claimed their centrality to the election result because they have a product to sell. So it's very hard, I think, to disentangle those sorts of narratives from actually saying, well, you know, how significant is this? And part of the reason is we don't really have the data. There's very few studies that actually work with the types of data that do get purchased for advertising or do get used to communicate with voters. I mean, I can think of one. It's not a Facebook study, but it's a targeting study. Ethan Hirsch's work in the US, where he actually uses data from the data reseller Catalyst. And interestingly, what he finds, it's probably not as effective as people think it is. Or if it is effective, the thing that makes it effective is the fact that many American voters register for primaries as partisans, and this is the crucial factor in actually making the data any good. So basically what he's saying is, yeah, if you tell the database you're a Democrat or Republican, that makes it quite good at targeting, but much, much harder to do with other sorts of data. So he's slightly skeptical. And you know, that's one of the few studies where we actually have someone trying to measure the effectiveness of this data. Mm-hmm. So there's a combination of narrative and particular arguments people are making, quite often in their own interests, coupled with really not much understanding as to how effective it is. But that doesn't mean we shouldn't be worried about it, and it doesn't mean we shouldn't be studying it.
Yeah, and I think you bring up an interesting point, which is this study comes from the US, and a lot of this research comes out of the US. And I think what you do a good job in the paper is looking at what specific context or external factors are, you know, specific to Britain, mm-hmm. and then broadening that out to Europe and other parts of the world as well. I mean, can we look at the majority of the research comes out of the US, but is that necessarily generalizable to other parts?
Well, look, it's a great starting point, and theory building is always going to be very important. And, you know, if we can use research in one context and use it to develop hypotheses in another context, that's fantastic. But we should always be aware of difference as well. So institutions matter, regulation matters, political culture matters. And, you know, well, I say we're trying to study the UK context and put that in context. We probably know a little bit more about Western Europe than we do about many other parts of the world. So it's, you know, really worth thinking about what are our blind spots there. You know, for example, in countries with less strong regulatory regimes, you know, do these types of technologies pose even greater challenges there? Mm. And so, you know, the number of questions we can ask is astronomical.
Well, let's dive into your take on those questions, where you and your team were able to use browser tracking technology developed by the team at Who Targets Me to get some empirical data on British parties' Facebook advertising in the 2017 election. So can you describe a bit your data set and the main questions you were trying to answer with that study?
Yeah, so I mean, it's a great data set, and that's really down to the brilliant people at Who Targets Me who developed this technology. And really, if you like, we divide it into two halves. We have, I think, just over 700 unique adverts. So in other words, individual pieces of content that political parties have uploaded. I should say in the context of this paper, we define political adverts as being those purchased by political parties. So it, you know, it's a relatively narrow definition of politics. There are other pieces of work out there by other people that take different definitions. For example, looking at dark ads or ads that are not necessarily purchased by recognized political actors. So it's sort of slightly different area of study. And then we also have a data set of what we call ad impressions. And I think there's about 11,000 of these. And by that, we mean the appearance of a particular ad in someone's timeline. What we can then also do is couple that up with the data that people gave us when they installed the plugin. So their age, their gender, and the constituency in which they live. So we can say a little bit as well about the individuals there and then try and link that back to the ad data.
And what were the approaches you were taking? Because if you have this data set, I mean, it's only as good as you interpret it, right? So what exactly were you trying to figure out by using this data?
So I think something that really intrigued us is to what extent are maybe our instinctive thoughts about data targeting and Facebook adverts, are they borne out by this data set? So the kind of image we probably have of Facebook targeting is it's highly segmented, it's very nimble, it maybe has the ability to work across diverse topics. And so I guess what we kind of wanted to find out was, well, does this stand up, right? Does this stand up to scrutiny when you look at the data set? Now, let me say a caveat right now that's really important, which is we're very aware of the limitations of the data set, right? So the brilliant people who installed this plugin, you know, because they cared about this and think that it's important to understand what parties are doing on Facebook, you know, these are fantastic people who are doing something really important. But unfortunately, probably in terms of thinking about these issues and being that aware of them, that means they're probably not typical of the average voter. So we know, for example, that the people who installed the plugin were about 80% men. The average age was about 5 years younger than the British average. So the average age was about 35, whereas the average in the UK is 40. And also we know that they're not evenly distributed across constituencies. So broadly, if you look at the constituencies with the very highest number of installations, I should say we had good coverage across the constituencies. Yeah, there were very few constituencies where no one had installed the plugin. But if you look at those that had the very highest number of installations, they tended to conform to a particular pattern. They were urban constituencies with young populations. They maybe were close to universities. So they were sort of disproportionately represented within the data set. Mm. So the big risk, I guess, with that is there are whole segments of the electorate we're not really seeing, right? Mm-hmm. So if ads are targeted at them, we're not seeing it. So let me give you an example of that. We don't have a single ad from UKIP in our data set. Now, that might be to do with the type of campaign UKIP ran. UKIP had a lot of problems at that particular time. They were in a bit of a mess. But it might also be that we didn't have the types of people installing the plugin who UKIP were then going to target with that.
Yeah, and I think it's, I mean, on the one hand, the limitations are, I think, okay, because this is the only type of data that we have on this. But one of the things that I want to stress before we get into the findings and the analysis is that this is only from a web browser, right, and not from a mobile phone. And I think that's a big one when most of that traffic comes through mobile phones.
It's only from one web browser. Mm-hmm. I think if you would have talked to the Who Targets Me people now, I think they've developed a Firefox version since this particular iteration of the project. But yeah, so we're missing other browsers and we're missing phones. And mm-hmm. and clearly, you know, the phones thing is astronomically important potentially because we know that the vast, vast majority of Facebook's ad revenue comes from mobile.
Exactly. So I want to focus on the variables or the aspects that you wanted to test with the study. And those are at least four: content, negativity, personalization, and calls to action. And most academics listening will probably be familiar with why these are chosen, but I'd like to highlight the logic in choosing to test these variables specifically. Why are studying these important in light of what we know from previous literature, which mostly deals with offline campaigning?
Yeah, I mean, I think you've kind of hinted at the answer in the way you frame the question, which is, I think we were as much interested in continuity as we were in change. Mm. I think that, again, there's a very sort of natural tendency, which I think anyone in this field is probably a bit familiar with, but probably all guilty of sometimes. I know I have been, which is to emphasize change and to emphasize how things have become very different because of technology. But these four metrics, if you like, are kind of staples of the discipline. They all also raise, I think, important theoretical questions. So if you look at something like negativity, you know, there's been a long debate for 20, 30 years in the discipline about negativity and what impact it has on democratic discourse and people's predispositions towards democratic life. Does it actually, so one argument is negative ads basically turn voters off all politicians and makes them feel more negative towards politics generally. So if Facebook is in, you know, massively increasing the negative ad traffic, then that, you know, there are very real reasons to be concerned by that. You know, personalization is another sort of traditional measure. And particularly in recent years, the argument is we've seen increased personalization in Western, particularly parliamentary politics. So again, it would be interesting to see, well, is that continuing to happen is Facebook kind of picking up where television left off, because quite often that personalization is linked to a particular mode of communication. So what we wanted to do was to have these benchmark measures, which, yeah, they're theoretically important, but they also allow us to compare with previous data sets for other media and say, well, you know what, is this a continuing trend? Is it an acceleration? Is it something completely different? And to have that link between continuity and change in our analysis.
Yeah, I think it's so important to view these technologies in their broader context of media, right? From radio to television to digital, social, internet. I mean, you got to keep that perspective in focus. But you also created a second data set, and I love this, the political ad density metric. Can you describe what the political ad density metric is and what were you trying to study with that?
It sounds way more complicated than it is, because it isn't really. So there was a problem with the data set. In fact, there were a couple of problems, and it was a way of correcting and controlling for that problem. So the two problems were, well, one I've already mentioned is we had an uneven distribution of users across the different constituencies. So in some constituencies, 200 people had installed the plugin, and in some constituencies, 5 installed the plugin. So, you know, kind of obvious, but you couldn't just add up the political ads in the data set and say, aha, that constituency had got more ads than the other one, because it probably had more users.
Right.
The other problem is the time over the election campaign. In other words, we were working really hard, Who Targets Me were working really hard to tell people about the plugin, to push it on social media and to go on mainstream media and talk about it. So over the course of the campaign, that was successful and we increased the number of people who installed it. But again, the problem with that is that means if you're comparing day one of the campaign with day 30, you potentially get a really warped sense of what's going on. So the political ad density was a way to tackle this problem. And in order to understand it, I'll just explain how the plugin works. It grabs every ad in your Facebook feed, political or non-political. So what we figured out we could do was, per constituency per day, we could figure out the proportion of political adverts that were appearing among all the adverts that people were seeing. And the value of that is it controls for the different number of people in the constituency, it controls for the amount of time they're spending online, and it controls for the number of installations we have over the various days of the campaign. So it's a way of correcting for those problems with unevenness within the data set. But basically what it means is you end up with a percentage. Normally it's a very low percentage, even in constituencies that are being highly targeted, but a percentage of ads from all the ads that have been harvested that were purchased by political parties.
Mm-hmm. So I want to go into some of the findings of the study. And I think one of the more interesting ones was the content variable. I think it's interesting that you find Brexit played a big role for some parties that were targeting ads, but not others. So how much did Brexit factor into the content that parties were targeting during the election?
Right, so let me just be really clear in answering this question. You're right to zone in on the content variable, by which we mean the topic the ad covered. I can make a different argument to you about the nature of electoral geography and how that relates to Brexit, but that's a sort of slightly different point. Mm. But the point in terms of the content is that the Conservative Party, who very publicly, Theresa May, the Prime Minister, said when she called the election, this is an election about Brexit, it's an election about giving me a mandate to do Brexit. Brexit was hugely present in their adverts. Labour, a party that potentially has a problem with Brexit because of the nature of its coalition, which is made up of maybe younger, more urban, more affluent supporters who would maybe be against Brexit, but also supporters who live in maybe post-industrial parts of the country where Labour has traditionally been strong, who maybe had a higher propensity to vote Leave. And that's a problem for them in their targeting and in their communication. They don't mention it at all. Now, this is interesting, right? There's a couple of things I think we can take away from this. So one of the big fears in conversations about Facebook targeting is that you're going to see contradictory messages coming out. In other words, parties are going to target one group of voters with something they want to hear and another group of voters with something that that group of voters wants to hear. We don't find evidence of that in the case of the Labour Party. We just find them omitting to talk about it. What they do talk about are the kind of things that they were talking about in the national campaign. They talk about healthcare, and they talk about public services, and they talk about austerity, and they talk about spending. So if you look at both Labour and the Conservatives, the things they are spending their money on in terms of communicating on Facebook are exactly the things they're communicating in the traditional air war, you know, the traditional campaign narrative that they have built up. Now, there's an interesting caveat to this, which is the nature of this election campaign, right? It was a snap election. It wasn't planned very far in advance. It wasn't in the fixed schedule of British elections. So maybe the way that the medium would be used would look different in the event of parties having a longer time to plan and to define who they're targeting with particular messages. So maybe there's something about this election in particular that meant parties defaulted to these big, grand narratives. But nevertheless, right, it's interesting. It suggests the kind of nightmare scenario of hyper-segmentation and contradiction is a bit more complicated than that.
Yeah, and when you're talking about the political ad density variables and what you were looking at there, you find that the conservatives were most efficient at targeting marginalized constituencies, whereas Labor did not show any significant correlation between political ad density and marginalized constituencies. So that suggests that Facebook targeting might not be as statistically sophisticated as we might tend to think. And, you know, I think one aspect is that snap election factor. Maybe they couldn't mobilize at a pace, you know, using old data sets, for example. But you make an interesting point about the human error in targeting in Facebook. So I wondered if you could go into that.
Well, let me be clear what we did. So we defined marginal in quite a traditional way. We simply meant how many votes behind or ahead was a particular party. So this is an idea you would have in a sort of first past the post parliamentary democracy of what's called universal national swing. So the idea that constituencies behave fairly uniformly, and this is the trajectory that seats are going to go on if you have a 5% swing from Labour to the Conservative, that sort of calculation. Now, it might be that, well, there are a couple of possible different explanations for what's going on. So one is, yeah, not very good targeting or not very good data. So we know, for example, the nature of that snap election, the Tories were working on data from 2015. They hadn't had a chance to build a new data set. And maybe that means they weren't really targeting the right people. But another possible explanation is just different strategic objectives. So let's take a look at Labour, right? So Labour at the start of the campaign were a long, long way behind the polls. They were like 20 points behind in the polls. So maybe at that point you're trying to do damage limitation, right? So your definition of a marginal seat isn't one where you're 100 votes behind. It might be one where you're 10,000 votes ahead, because they're the seats you could potentially lose, but where campaign activity could make a difference. So maybe that's your definition. There were also rumours before the election that the people around Jeremy Corbyn, the Labour leader, in order to preserve his leadership, wanted to make the case that they weren't interested in winning seats, they were interested in national vote share. And if that's your strategic objective, then it doesn't matter where you target, you just pile up votes in safe seats. You're still achieving your goal. Okay, in some ways it kind of is not the naturally rational way to approach that electoral system, but if your goal is to deal with intra-party competition rather than competition in the actual election, then maybe that's a logical thing to do. The final point to make is the nature of this targeting might also change the fundamental definition of what's marginal. So again, as I said, we use this very traditional definition. How many votes behind, how many votes ahead you are, what percentage change you would need to win it. If you look at what the Tories did in 2015 with their targeting techniques, the story here is they ran a very heavily targeted campaign and they identified that their coalition partners, the Liberal Democrats, seats which they held were vulnerable because a significant proportion of their voters liked the message about, let's put it this way, they were worried about a Labour government, and therefore they responded well and liked the message of, well, if you vote Conservative, you might be able to keep Labour out. And of course, what the Conservatives were able to do was to win huge numbers of those seats from their coalition partners with those messages. But that's because they identified a group of voters who were very responsive to them. Those weren't traditionally marginal seats. You know, the majorities were very large. But because they were able to target specific voters, they fundamentally shifted the definition of what a marginal and a target seat looked like. So it could be that there were strategies that we're not aware of. And, you know, something we didn't try and do in this paper, and we were really keen not to try and do because it's not really possible, was to reverse engineer the logic of the campaign. Yeah, there's too many variables. It's too complicated. It's political judgment filtered through a Facebook algorithm. You know, the amount of data you would need to do that to make those kind of judgments is huge. You know, I suspect really the way, if you want to understand those sorts of questions, is actually to go and talk to the people, do, you know, traditional qualitative interviews, talk to the people who took those decisions about, well, how did they see this media working for them and who was it they thought they were targeting?
Yeah, and going along the lines of these strategies, I thought one of the interesting things is that despite the differences between the Conservatives and Labour in terms of their political ad density, you find that the political ad density was high for both parties in areas that were pro-Brexit, right? The top constituencies that were targeted were tended to be heavily pro-Brexit. So I was wondering, how do you interpret that finding?
Well, I think that probably fits into what we've just been discussing, that in the sense of after the referendum, this was perceived as being the battleground where the election would be won or lost. And if Labour could retain those sorts of seats, then they would stand a good chance of arresting the progress of the Conservatives. But the Conservatives certainly thought, and I think all the literature that's come out since the election backs this up, they certainly thought that if they could start to win over people who would be regarded as traditional Labour voters, maybe previously voted for UKIP in one election,
If they could win them over to the Conservative Party with a pro-Brexit message, then they could start to make huge inroads into those Labour heartlands. And, you know, I don't think there was any doubt that was their strategy. Labour sought to defend that position. So in that sense, the types of seats that we've identified in our data set as being most targeted do make, I think, quite a lot of sense in the context of the electoral topography, both in terms of how that election turned out, but also how it was fought during the course of the campaign.
And one more question on the findings, which has to do with negativity. And I thought there was an interesting part in your paper talking about how some of the ads sought to demobilize voters by telling them that voting for this party was a wasted vote, this idea of tactical voting or tactical advice. And I was wondering if looking at the ads, did you notice that, because when you're offering tactical advice, you have to kind of keep into the context of that constituency and that specific seat. So did you notice looking at those ads, were those plug and play in the sense that they would just change the name of the constituency but not the overall ad? Or were they kind of crafted to, let's say, the industry of this particular region of the country?
No, I don't think they were particularly crafted. I think they were much more plug and play. I think there's also an interesting regulatory danger here, which is what's the definition of national and local campaigning, and what then filters through into those two different types of campaign, because the United Kingdom is regulated through two spending caps, one national, one local. And something we've seen, not just on Facebook, but in other forms of direct contact campaigning in recent years, has been a sort of bastardized local campaigning, but run by national parties. And certainly some of them have got themselves in trouble with the Electoral Commission for this. But I think, you know, it's a profoundly important question, right? How do we actually regulate these spaces? How do they fit with traditional modes of regulation? So that national-local distinction that I've just been talking about. It's an interesting question, though, about, well, what do you then define as a local ad? Is it like a magic words test, right? If you mention the constituency, if you mention the name of the candidate, does that become a local ad? Because some of the ads we're seeing didn't do that. They just simply said, voting Liberal Democrats is a waste of your vote. Mm. But we knew, because we had the postcode of the person who'd been targeted, that that advert was shaped by local context. Mm. So I think there's an interesting question there about, well, actually, should that be defined as a local ad? It's clearly working within the context of the electoral landscape that exists in that constituency, even though it wouldn't necessarily fail a magic words test.
Exactly. And, you know, you touched on this idea of regulating and kind of moving into the space from a policy standpoint. And that's kind of what you end your paper on. You outline three challenges facing researchers and also regulators when studying Facebook ad targeting in elections specifically. And one is epistemological, one is conceptual, and the third is systemic. So I was wondering if you could briefly give us an overview of what are those challenges for researchers and also regulators moving forward in political communication.
Yeah, sure. So as I say, you said the three areas we identify that are particularly challenging is, yeah, the epistemological. How do we study this, right? How do we know about this space? How do we get away from or understand the sort of the discourses around it? You know, because not without good reason, but there have been some quite a lot of sort of sensationalist discourses around this. Do we actually have the evidence to kind of effectively engage with those sorts of debates? And, you know, who targets me? The people who created that, it's a brilliant piece of work, but it's a hacked solution, right? We know the data set we have is imperfect. I should say that since we did this study, Facebook have opened up considerably. You know, I think there's more Facebook data that they are putting out there. But I think there's a really interesting question about, should Facebook's move towards transparency, is that sufficient? Yes, essentially, should they be able to police themselves? Or do we need different sorts of open ways to access this data? What data should be provided to electoral regulators? What capacity do election regulators need to actually study that data? So that's the epistemological challenge, right? How do we know? But also, what kind of bureaucracy do we need to know? What kind of data do we need to know? What kind of institutions regulate it? Mm-hmm. Then the next question we talk about is the conceptual. And this, I guess, kind of talks about some of the very kind of classical ideas that you would find in political communications literature, but you might also find in electoral regulation literature. So something I've mentioned in our conversation is this distinction between the local and the national campaign. Again, kind of a classic idea. There's literature on both of them and how they interact. But how useful is that terminology even at a point in time where these sorts of ads can be purchased centrally but highly targeted to one household or street? Mm-hmm. So do we need to rethink that terminology? Another term which is very important for electoral regulators around the world is collusion. And indeed, the particularly big story that's happened in the UK since the 2016 referendum is that the Vote Leave campaign have been found guilty of collusion by the Electoral Commission. What they have been found guilty of doing is funneling money through organisations that they claimed were separate, but the Electoral Commission do not believe were separate. But those organisations were used to purchase Facebook ads in excess of the campaign spending limit. But this again gets very complicated in a sort of a network data-based environment. What does collusion actually look like in that space, which is inherently about sharing information? So we need better definitions. We need more effective definitions. We need definitions that are easier for campaigns and for citizens to understand. And then I guess we move on to the systemic challenge. So the systemic challenge, really, this is about understanding how adverts fit into the broader ecosystem. I mean, political scientists and political communication scholars, we're sort of quite fashion-driven in terms of what we study. And the zeitgeist, a few years ago was much more optimistic. It was about how Facebook was going to, and social media generally, were going to help people self-mobilize and self-organize, and people are going to be able to form their own organizations with very low barriers to collective action. That's still all true, right? All those things can still happen. We just moved on a bit because now we're more concerned about advertising, and in the age of Brexit and Trump, then they seem like very pressing concerns, understandably. But both can be true at the same time. So then the question is, well, how do they interact with each other? Yeah, so what is the role of the organic nature of Facebook with citizens and activists with the advertising side of Facebook? What also relationship do bots play in that? Because obviously there's been a lot of discussion and literature on bots and international involvement in elections and attempts to subvert elections. So what's the role that these, if you like, sort of tripartite aspects of Facebook, advertising, bots, and civic activism, how they interact? And then the even bigger question, the very biggest question of all, which is, well, how does Facebook fit into a broader media system? How does it relate to other social media? How does it relate to Twitter? How does it relate to traditional media and print media? How important is it to the business models of legacy media organizations that are now online? What sort of new media organizations is it creating, facilitating? And so the very big question there is, well, how does it fit into the ecosystem, in its totality? This is a very small window, this paper, into one aspect of that set of questions, but they're vast.
It is, and they are vast, but I thought the paper does a very good job in both focusing on ads and really bringing the British context and what those campaign finance regulations, for example, mean. And I think that the three challenges that you outline at the end are definitely big questions, but I like to see them put out in such a way that is sort of transparent, which I think fits with the scope of the paper. So Dr. Anstead, thank you so much for taking the time out and being on the first outdoor Social Media and Politics podcast.
It's been lovely. Thanks for having me.
I've just been speaking with Dr. Nick Anstead, Associate Professor in Media and Communications at the London School of Economics and Political Sciences. Check the show notes for a link to that paper, and that's going to do it for this episode of the Social Media and Politics podcast. Thank you so much for tuning in, and I hope you enjoyed the show. Make sure you're subscribed to get all the latest episodes directly into your feed, and as always, you can follow us on Twitter at SMNP Podcast. I'm your host, Michael Becetta, signing off from Copenhagen. See you next time.